You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 157A, by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Spiritual Life Now and After Death, translated by Pauline Verla and Johanna Collis, revised. This is Lecture 4, entitled The Physical and Spiritual Worlds, given on December 7, 1915. In every domain, spiritual science has to show us the connection between the spiritual worlds and the world that we perceive through our senses while in our earthly bodies, and that we seek to grasp through intellectual thoughts. In several lectures, we have dealt especially with the connection between the life a human being leads as a soul between death and rebirth, and the life passed here while incarnated in a physical body. We must always keep firmly in mind that human beings, so long as they live in physical bodies, direct their thoughts to the sphere that they must experience after death and before birth. We direct our thoughts to that sphere, not to satisfy mere curiosity, but because we have always been able to persuade ourselves through our spiritual science that in turning our thought to that other world, we are able to contribute to this world by ennobling and invigorating the concepts needed for our actions, thoughts, feelings, and so on. We must hold firmly to the thought that many of life's secrets can be solved only if we have the courage to approach what may be called the mystery of death. Now today, to consider the connection between the spiritual and sense world from a particular perspective, we may begin with a trivial observation, yet one that involves profound feeling. We will start with the fact we have often discussed, the fact that human beings go through the gate of death. I repeat, we start from something that is an everyday occurrence, but is connected with very deep experiences, gripping humans in the depths of their souls. As you know, when we stand face to face with people here in the physical world, we form thoughts that can unite us to them. We surround them with feelings of sympathy or antipathy, and so on. We feel either friendship or enmity for them. Briefly, we form here in the physical world a certain relation to other people. This relation may arise through ties of blood, or it may be brought about by the preferences that occur in daily life. All this can be comprehended in the expression, the relation of person to person. Now, when people with whom we have been united through various ties leave the physical world and pass through the gates of death, at first there remains to us the memory of them, that is, a number of feelings and thoughts that have arisen as a result of our relation to them and that we ourselves have experienced. But since they passed away from us through the gates of death, these thoughts and feelings that united us with them now live on in a very different manner. While they lived with us here on the physical plane, we knew that at any time, in addition to the relation our souls had formed to them, the outer physical presentment itself might also appear. We knew that we could bring our inner experience to bear upon this outer reality of theirs. And if at any time, by some means, these people changed, we had to expect that the feelings we formerly had toward them would also change in one way or another. We do not often think of the radical difference it makes when suddenly, or even not suddenly, the moment comes when, henceforward, we can only carry in our soul the memory of our friends, when we know, quote, "Never again will our eyes see them or our hands grasp theirs," close quote. The picture we formed of them remains fundamentally as already fixed. but a radical change appears in the relation between us and the departed. As has been said, it may sound trivial, but it cuts deeply into the inner life in each individual case. When a human soul that formerly impressed us from without, by means of its physical embodiments, becomes nothing but a memory. Let us now compare such a memory with others that we construct from our experience. A great part of our physical life is lived in memory. We know what we ourselves have experienced. We know, for instance, the events that have occurred to us and for which we have retained ideas. We know that we can revert to times now past through these thoughts, times in which the events in question took place. Now, however, if we examine the contents of the greater part of these recollections, we find that in our thoughts we bear something within us that is no longer here, past events, events that, as reality, we can no longer meet with in the external world, for they belong to the past. If we have absorbed some of the thoughts of spiritual science, then the memory of our dead, or of one who has gone through the gates of death, is quite different from our soul's gaze. We then hold thoughts in us, but these thoughts are fixed on reality, a reality certainly not accessible to us in the external physical world, but existing in the spiritual world. That to which those thoughts are directed is present, although it cannot enter the sphere of our vision. But there is quite a different conception in our memory from the mere remembrance of what occurred here in the physical world. Now, if we observe the fact involved in this, in relation to the entire cosmos, we can then say that we carry in our souls thoughts of a being who is in the spiritual world. Now we know, and this must be especially clear to us from the considerations pursued here in the last three lectures, we know that not only does the longing of souls incarnated here ascend to the spiritual world, but that the consciousness of those who have passed through the gates of death and who are now living in the intermediate world between death and rebirth also extends to what transpires here in the physical world. We can say those discarnate souls who live in the spiritual world receive into their consciousness from the physical world what their spiritual gaze and their spiritual vision directed down to earth enables them to perceive. I pointed out in one of the last lectures how souls still incarnated here in physical bodies can be perceived by the so-called dead and distinguished from souls who are already discarnate and living in the intermediate stage between death and rebirth. I explained that souls living in the spiritual world must continually be active in order to acquire any perception. For instance, they may be aware that another soul is quite near them, but in order to perceive it, they must exert inner activity. They have, as it were, to construct a picture. The picture will not appear of itself, as it does here in the physical world. In the spiritual world comes first the thought of, quote, an existing presence, close quote, and then one must, as it were, inwardly experience this existing entity so that the picture may arise. The process is reversed, for there is a significant difference in the construction of a picture, which refers to those souls already in the spiritual world, and the picture of such as are still incarnate on the earth. The discarnate soul must produce the picture of a soul that is already in the spiritual world entirely from itself, and it must be thoroughly active in so doing. However, it may remain more passive in reference to a soul still living on the earth, and then the picture rather comes to it. The effort made is much slighter, as regards a soul living on the earth, than with one already discarnate. Less inner activity is necessary. And this represents the distinction between the two, to those souls living between death and rebirth. If you grasp this, you will realize that after the soul has passed through the gates of death and lives the life of the spiritual world, it not only beholds the beings of the higher hierarchies and the other human souls living with it in the spiritual world, but there also appears the world of souls to which it was related before going through the gates of death. The important distinction must be firmly retained that while human beings here on earth have what constitutes earthly existence actually around them, and can only comparatively speaking grasp the other world in spirit, this is reversed upon entering the spiritual world. What the soul can there see of itself, without an effort, is our world, and from there it is, quote, the other world, close quote. But the soul must exert itself to make its own world, the world in which it then is, always perceptible, and must always construct it for itself. Thus, when human beings are in the spiritual world, it is that world on which they must continually work. And what is then to them the other world always arises as if of itself. But now, within this other world, which for us on earth is this world, there appears the human souls, with what lives in them, especially those human souls with whom relations were established during life on earth. These human souls appear. Now, within this sea of spiritual perception that we make here in our souls of the other world, there occasionally appear the memories of those who have gone through the gates of death. Picture this very clearly to yourselves. Let us suppose that we lived in a time in which nobody could remember any dead person. The dead would still perceive these human souls, in which there lived no memory of the dead. In this ocean of spiritual perceptions that the discarnate souls can see, are preserved the memories of the dead. They live within it. That is something that through humans' free will and love, here is added to what the dead can always see from the other side. Thus it is something added. Now here again we come to a point when important questions arise to the spiritual investigator. Here is one question that the spiritual investigator must investigate. Of what significance is it to those who have gone through the gates of death when they now see embedded in the souls ebbing and flowing in our world the memories that these souls streaming by have of the dead? When they perceive these memories, what do they mean to them? Now, in spiritual investigation, when such a question arises, it must first of all be thoroughly experienced. One must live into it. If one begins to speculate as to a possible solution to such a question, as to a possible answer, one will certainly arrive at a false conclusion. For the effort of the ordinary brain-fettered understanding gives, as a rule, no solution that can only be ascertained through inner activity. The answers to questions relating to the enigmas of the spiritual world descend from the spiritual world as by an act of grace. One must wait. There is really nothing else to be done but to live with the question and meditate on it again and again. Let it live in the soul with all the feelings aroused by it, and then calmly wait. Wait till one is worthy, that is the right word, worthy to receive an answer from the spiritual world. And as a rule, this comes from a quarter quite different from what one might expect. Thus, the answer comes from the spiritual world at the right moment, that is, at the moment when one has sufficiently prepared one's soul to receive the answer. As to whether it is then the right answer can as little be decided theoretically as can any statement concerning physical reality. Experience alone can furnish the criterion. To those who are always denying spiritual reality by saying, quote, that cannot be proved and everything must be proved, close quote, I should like to put one question. Would it have been possible to prove the existence of a whale in the physical world if none had ever been discovered? Nothing can be proved unless it can be shown in the same way as a reality. Even in the spiritual world, one must experience what is reality. Now, what enters one's consciousness as the solution may, of course, appear in many different forms, according to the preparation one has made in one's soul. The truth may present itself in many ways, but nevertheless it must be experienced as the truth. For example, if one lets the above question live aright in the soul, there then appears, apparently from quite a different quarter, a picture, an inner picture, which I may say gives one an inner impression of offering something concerning the solution of the mystery in question. The picture may arise of a man who allows himself to be photographed or has his portrait painted. The principal point in the picture will be some physical thing, an image of this physical thing. And there finally arises all that pertains to the realm of art, to the artistic presentation. Now, if you consider how physical life runs its course, you know that in physical life, humanity is confronted with the outer occurrences of nature, the external beings and events of nature. They run their course and expire. It is similar with all human concerns, with what people attend to and plan for their necessities, and so on, with what they make as history. But beyond all this humanity, beyond all this, humanity seeks something that really has nothing to do with the immediate necessities of the world. The human soul is aware that if nature and history merely ran their course in connection with the satisfaction of human needs, life would become barren and desolate. Human beings create here, in physical existence, something above and beyond the course of nature and necessity. They do not merely feel the need of seeing a certain landscape, but also of copying it. They arrange their lives so that anyone connected with them can get one or more copies of it. Starting from this, we can think of the whole realm of art as something that humanity creates here, that is a reality higher than the ordinary reality pertaining to nature and history. Just consider what the world would miss if there were no art. If art did not add what she can produce from her own sources to what is self-existing, art creates something that, if one may say, need not of necessity exist. If she were not there, all the necessities of nature might still go on. One may suppose that even if no single copy of nature had been made and no artistic representation, life would still pursue its course from the beginning to the end of earth. We can picture to ourselves all that humanity would then be without. But theoretically, it might be possible for our earth to be punished through the inability to evolve any art. We have in art something extending beyond life. Think of all that art has created in the world, and the progress of humankind through the world. There you have, in a sense, two parallel progressive processes: the necessities of nature and history, and the stream of art that is inserted in them. Now, just as art, in a sense, brings as by enchantment a spiritual world into the world of physical reality, so another world conjures up into the world of those who have gone through the gates of death these memories that fill our souls here. As far as the dead are concerned, the world here might run its course without any memories living in the souls here, memories born of love and all our human relationships. But then the world of the dead would be to them as a world would be to us, in which we could find nothing transcending ordinary reality. That is an extraordinarily significant connection. For through the thoughts of love, through the memories, and all that thus transpires in our souls in connection with those no longer in the physical world, there is created for the dead something analogous to artistic creation here. Whereas here in the physical world people must bring artistic creation from their own souls, contributing something from their own being, the opposite must occur for those now in the spiritual world. It must be brought to them from, quote, the other world, close quote, and from the souls still incarnated here, the souls whom they can contemplate more passively than those already with them in the spiritual world. What the course of nature and history would be to us if it ran on simply of itself, without art, without everything humans create above and beyond the immediate reality, such would our world be for the dead, if the souls still on the physical plane retained no memories of them. Now, such things as these are not really known in the physical life of humanity. We may put it thus. These things are not known by the ordinary consciousness, but the deeper subconscious is aware of them, and life is always directed in accordance with this. Why has a value always been laid by human communities on the celebration of All Souls' Day and Days for the Dead? And those who cannot share in the usual memorials for the dead have, nevertheless, their own days set apart for this. Why is this? Because in the depths of humans' subconscious, there lives what may be called a dim knowledge of what takes place in the world by keeping alive the memory of the dead. When the receptive soul of the seer celebrates All Souls' Day, a Sunday devoted to the dead, or some similar day when many people come together full of the memories of their dead, they see the dead participate in the ceremony. To them it is with certain natural differences, as it is here, when on our world people visit a cathedral and behold those forms that they could never see unless something had been created out of the artist's imagination, unless something had been added to physical existence. It is the same when they hear a symphony or music of that sort. Something is reproduced in all these memories, which in a sense transcends the ordinary level of existence. And as art inserts herself into the physical course of human history, so do these memories insert themselves into the picture of their world that the souls between death and rebirth receive. In such customs, which are formed in human communities, that secret knowledge contained in the depths of the soul finds expression. And many a worthy custom is connected with this deeper subconsciousness. We feel greater reverence for the connections of life when we can permeate them with what spiritual science offers to us, than if we are unable to do this. Each time dead people contact a remembrance of themselves in the soul of a person who was in some way connected with them here, it is always as if something streamed over to them that beautified their life and enhanced its value. And as to us here, beauty comes from art, so to the dead beauty streams to them from what rays forth out of the hearts and souls of those who keep them in memory. Yet is one connection between the world here and the spiritual world there. And this thought is closely connected with that other thought, which should arise from much of what can be cultivated in spiritual science, the thought of the value and importance of earthly life. Spiritual science does not lead us to despise the earth, with all that it can bring forth. It leads us rather to consider life as a part of the whole life of the cosmos, as a necessary part, which is arranged in conformity with what is active in the spiritual world, and without which the spiritual world would not appear in its perfection. And henceforth, when we turn our attention to the fact that from out of our physical world must spring forth beauty for the dead, we are struck by the thought that the spiritual world would lack this beauty if there were no physical world with the human souls, who, while still in the body, were able to evolve thoughts full of feeling and sentiment for those no longer in this world. It signified a great deal in ancient times when whole peoples, over and over again, devoted themselves reverently at their festivals to the thought of their great ancestors, and united in feeling for the memory of their great forebears. It was extremely significant when they inaugurated such memorial days. It always meant the flashing up of something beautiful for the spiritual worlds, that is, for the souls living there between death and rebirth. And while here on earth it is not very rational, to put it mildly, to take special pleasure in one's own portrait, nevertheless, for the dead it is important to find their image in those souls who still remain here. We must bear well in mind that our earthly human beings appear very different to us when we consider them from the perspective of the spiritual, from the perspective of the dead. We have often emphasized this. Here we are enclosed within our skin. What we designate as we and as I, what is most precious to us, is shut in by our skin. This holds good even for the most selfless people. Perhaps it holds good for them to a higher degree than for those who consider themselves less selfless. First and foremost, we value what is shut up inside this skin. Then comes the rest of the world. We regard that as our outer world. But the most significant thing is that when we are outside our bodies, we are one with the outer world and live in it. I have often described this, in quotes, going forth, this expansion of oneself over the outer world. And what then bears the same relation to us as does the outer world now is just what we have experienced here between birth and death. In a sense, we can say that the outer world becomes our inner world, and what is now our inner world then becomes our outer world. Hence that significant experience on entering the land of the Spirit, quote, "Thou art that," close quote, described in my book titled Theosophy. We then look back at our external world here, which is encompassed by our I. But there, the soul, unable to be as egoistic as it was here, looks back on the thoughts that appear as thoughts of itself. That is, as it were, the external world that confronts it, which is really incorporated into the compass of what we can designate the beautiful, exalts one. Something comes into this, which has become an outer world, consisting of the memory of all we have undergone between birth and death, that does not live in this and does not belong to this life of ours, but lives in other souls and relates itself to us. That really means the insertion of something transcending ourselves, transcending our outer world. Just as here some work of art rises above the ordinary reality that exists in itself. And just as it is improper for people here to be in love with themselves and also with their own portrait, so there it is quite natural for people to stand in that sort of relation to what arises as an image in the souls left behind, the other presentation of themselves, to stand before that picture, just as here we stand before a landscape and compare it with the scene itself. Thus, when this question comes before the soul, one is shown the presentment of people and their picture, and from this one finds a way of answering the question. Speculation, as a rule, does not help at all. One must learn to wait patiently. In reality, one should only trouble oneself about the question relating to the spiritual world, for the answers can only be given to the human soul as by a revealing act of grace. In this picture, I have pointed out that certain arrangements, such as memorial festivals and days of remembrance, as organized by human beings, are connected with a profound knowledge outside the range of ordinary consciousness. That rests in the fact that people have, in the depths of their soul, a dim but comprehensive knowledge. I have repeatedly touched upon this, and that they actually draw the knowledge embraced by their consciousness from out of this comprehensive wisdom. I have pointed out how clever we should really be if we could embrace, with our ordinary consciousness, everything included in the astral body. This astral body goes through life wiser in a much higher sense than we usually believe. We do not value the wisdom of our astral body, because we are quite unaware of it. But we can at least form some idea of its comprehensive wisdom, if we place the following before our souls. Our lives are lived, as we might say, in the daytime. Now, we judge events very little according to their connections. If we consider them in their setting, many things would seem very, very different to us. Consider this. Suppose we made a plan, we propose doing something, and we decide in the morning that we intend doing it during the evening. At midday, something occurs that prevents us from fulfilling the evening plan. We are really vexed that we are not able to carry it out. We think how much finer and better it would have been if we had been able to accomplish that particular thing. The astral body, however, with its more embracing but subconscious knowledge, is of a different opinion. In such a case, the astral body often says, quote, "Yes, if you fulfill what you had intended for the evening, you will be put in a position in which you may perhaps fall and break your leg." Close quote. Of course, it may be quite possible that we absolutely cannot avoid this, and if we accomplish in the evening what we have arranged, there may previously be a combination of circumstances that brings about the breaking of our leg. We do not know of this in our ordinary consciousness, but the astral body perceives it. And it therefore leads us into a position in which we ourselves prevent the fulfillment of the evening program. The intervention that vexes us so much is sometimes caused by this extraordinary wise knowledge of the whole setting of our life. It is not born of chance, but arises entirely from the wisdom of our astral body, of which we remain unconscious as regards our ordinary consciousness. If we could only see why we do some things and omit others, perhaps because we cannot do otherwise, or are led away first to something else, if we could perceive all that, we should see that there is always a connection in our life that proceeds from something within us wiser than we are in our ordinary consciousness. It is a part of our life's arrangement, but the whole purpose is not perceptible. But as soon as we rightly hold the thought in our minds of our connection with the spiritual world, the matter will then become clear to us. Over us there is a being that in a limited sense belongs to us, the being of the hierarchy of the angels, our guardian angel. Indeed, at the present time we always turn, at the beginning of our lectures, to the guardian spirits of those who have to fulfill the severe demands of the time outside in the world. Now this guardian spirit of ours sees the whole connection. For a long time there has been a feeling in human consciousness that certain connections, imperceptible to us, are perceived by our guardian angel. Occasionally this happens. The boundary between what we can see and what we cannot see with ordinary consciousness varies. There are indeed people here who go through life with a certain inner satisfaction, because no matter what comes to them, they submit because they believe in a ruling wisdom. They are permeated with a feeling that even things that may feel annoying are also dominated by a ruling wisdom. It is often very difficult to believe in a ruling wisdom when something happens that interferes completely with our plans. But one of those very impulses that may easily bring us into close connection with the activities of the spiritual world consists in our feeling ourselves cared for by this ruling wisdom, without thereby becoming indolent or lazy, without believing that this wisdom works independently for us individually. Thus the boundary is movable. It varies greatly in relation to our actions and to the formation of intentions. In ordinary consciousness, there are certainly impulses of an intimate and delicate nature. How often does it happen that we plan something for a later time, then something occurs, and we feel that we must do this that will really hinder the later action? We have the feeling to act as immediate necessity demands, and to set about the matter with a certain delicacy, for we know if we set about it roughly, that it will disperse and vanish before us. We all have, to a greater or less degree within us, besides the self on which our freedom depends, a second self that wants to feel its way through life and believes it attains far more through what it gropes for than through what it can strictly measure by intellect. The boundary is movable. But at certain times, the boundary is even more adjustable. And now comes a point that should be correctly grasped with reference to practical life. There are persons, and in a certain respect we are all gripped by what rules in such people, there are persons who have a sort of longing, a sort of passion to order their life aright, so to traverse the paths of life that they can order it correctly. Let us take an exceptional case. Suppose a man, you know, forms a friendship for another. You may say, quote, I really cannot understand why he has formed this friendship. I cannot make it out. No real affinity exists between these two, yet he does all he can to approach this man. Close quote. It seems incomprehensible, and only a long time afterward we see the reason. The man in question may need the other for something much later on. He formed a friendship with him not because he found something in him that gave him pleasure. He did not form this friendship for its own sake, but as a means to something that would apply later. He regulated his life rightly. Through forming that friendship, he attained some prospect through which his friend could later help him in some situation. And the consequence is that something actually takes place through the help of the so-called friend that could not otherwise have occurred. If you apply this thought to life, you will see how often it occurs, that people arrange something that they do not immediately desire, but they wish it so arranged, because they will have need of its after effects. Thus we must say that there are people who, in the adjustment of their life, show an enormous subtlety. We cannot call this wisdom. We should feel an inner objection to calling it wisdom. But these people display great cunning in doing something at an earlier stage of their lives that cannot profit them in any way at the time, but can only do so at some later epoch. And we may express the following feeling, quote, I really do not think so and so was so clever, for when I approached him and exchanged thoughts with him or was in his society, he really seemed much too stupid to order his life so cleverly. Close quote. Now that comes about because what people carry in their astral body can be much cleverer than their ordinary consciousness. And if they strongly check their egoism and drive it down to the sphere of unconsciousness, if they do not live in accordance with a certain primitive instinct, but as it were allow their egoism to dominate, it then lays hold of their subconscious. And that other person that dwells in us all, but who as a rule trains us to take life in a more natural and direct manner, then guides us to organize our life and to create beforehand the conditions for something later. Then we see the astral body ruling with its cleverness, but permeated not by what usually dominates in life, but by the egoism forced out of the ordinary consciousness down into the astral consciousness. And we see such people, apparently, going through life with much more of what we might call calculation than should come to them from their ordinary consciousness. There are many dangerous sides to the evolution of the human soul. And it is very important to become aware of this, that the moment we meet what is ordinarily unconscious in us, we must try not to approach it with too much egoism. Therefore, the avoidance of egoism in the development toward the spiritual worlds must again and again be emphasized. For beneath our ordinary consciousness there really rules something that may be permeated by the consciousness of our guardian spirit from the hierarchy of the angels. Then arises what to the ordinary consciousness makes human beings seem to act without reflection, but that is nevertheless subject to a certain law. I expressed this law very simply in one of the mystery plays by letting one of the characters say, quote, the heart must often direct our karma, close quote. And if one transcends what the heart indicates as karma, and lets reason prevail, then reason sometimes administers a strong dose of egoism. Or it may be that egoism so prevails that we find people more subtle than they seem to be, judging by their ordinary consciousness. In that case, they have pressed the egoism down into their astral body. Then comes something into the working of their soul, not now from the regular beings of the hierarchy of the angels, but something luciferic, which enables people to embrace a wider sphere than they could consciously do at this present stage of their evolution. Thus we see that what must of necessity be strongly emphasized when one is approaching spiritual evolution is really something delicate and intimate, for we must of course strive to expand our consciousness. But in doing so, we should always take care to obliterate the hindrance that is created when our egoism is removed either into a deeper or a higher sphere of consciousness. You may ask, quote, how can we do this? Close quote. It is very easy to say that we should not remove egoism from our ordinary consciousness, but how are we to avoid doing this? Well, this cannot be done by rules, but solely through widening one's interests. When people extend their interests, they are always in some way already fighting their egoism. For with each new interest we acquire, we go a little beyond ourselves. Therefore we strive for spiritual science in this manner. That is, we are taught not only to pay attention to what human beings so willingly listen to because of egoism, but to have our interests really extended. How often does the demand arise again and again, quote, why are the books written in a way so difficult to understand? Could they not be written in a simpler fashion? Close quote. And someone or another makes suggestions as to how these books could be written for the people and made popular. One must really beware of gaining such popularity, for it only enhances egoism. If it were made so easy to enter spiritual science, then everyone could enter without overcoming their egoism. But in the work accomplished spiritually, by the efforts we have to make, we get rid of a little of our egoism. We enter what we wish to acquire through spiritual science in a more hallowed frame of mind, if we have had to take trouble over it, than if it had been presented to us in quite an easy and popular form. For example, a person has come home and said, quote, there are so many people who have to work all day long. If these people have to sit down in the evening and read these difficult books, they do not get on very well. For such as these, there ought to be books quite easy to read. Close quote. To this I had to answer, and quite correctly, quote, why should one prevent these people from applying even the little time at their disposal to reading such books as are purposely written with full regard to spiritual conditions? Why should they occupy the little time they have in reading books that may be more convenient, but that trivialize the matter even textually? Close quote. For it is just because these books do not place the soul in the right attitude that they drag down into the trivial life, which should lead one away from it, even as regards the nature of the experience connected with another sphere. It will become of special importance in spiritual science that we should bear in mind not only the what, the matter, but the how, the manner, that we should really bestir ourselves gradually to acquire ideas of a world quite different from the ordinary physical world, and thus gradually to accustom ourselves to form conceptions different from those we can build so comfortably in the physical world. And now in conclusion, I should like to mention a concept that we will need for our next lecture, but I shall mention it today so that you may see that it is well to assimilate new words for what transpires in the spiritual world. We have a word that expresses the manner of a person's life between birth and death, one that expresses this life as it strikes us. We see young children, fresh and rounded, their inner life flowing through their outer form, teeming, as we say, with inner life, until a certain year, when life pours itself into the outer form. Then comes a time when the inner life ceases to flow, when we become wrinkled and things change with us. In short, we can follow up this outer life from birth to death in the changes presented by the physical body as life runs its course. We call this growing old for the quite trivial reason that when we are born, the physical body is young, and when we die, it is old. Now, with the etheric body, the case is really quite different. Our etheric body is old, if we can use the word at all, in this connection. It is old through the forces by which it is fashioned at conception or birth. It is already old when we begin our physical life. It is then already formed and chiseled out, and it has a great many inner formations. They are movements, yet inner formations. These are taken from it as life proceeds. On the other hand, the life force is enhanced. It is young when we grow old. While we say we are aging in regard to the physical body, we must say we are growing young when speaking of the etheric body. And it is well to use this expression. We actually grow young in our etheric body, since at our birth its whole forces are directed to all that is enclosed in the human skin. When we pass through death at a certain age, the etheric body enters a certain relationship with the whole cosmos. It recovers the forces that have been taken from it. The moment we became children, its connection with the cosmos was broken. It had then to send all its forces into the small space enclosed in the human skin. It was compressed, as it were, to one point of the cosmos. Now the etheric body revives and gradually takes its place in the cosmos in proportion as the physical body ages. Although somewhat of an exaggeration, we may say that when we become wrinkled, the etheric body becomes chubby, and again becomes an image of the external force, the creative, abounding force, in the same way as the physical body is an expression of this force at the beginning of childhood. We grow young as regards our etheric body. Thus it will gradually become necessary to coin words wherewith really to grasp the absolutely different relations of the spiritual world. It is important that we should acquaint ourselves with this radical difference in the whole perception of the spiritual world as opposed to the physical world. We shall start our considerations next time from this point. Quote, "From the fighter's courage, from the blood of battles, from the mourner's suffering, from the people's sacrifice, there will ripen fruits of spirit if, with consciousness, the soul turns her thoughts to spirit realms." Close quote. The end of Lecture 4.